All right, everyone. Good to see you again. Welcome back to Systems. So last class, I wanted to kind of wrap up our discussion of signals with our activity with the graphing and stuff. So hoping to see more of y'all. Sorry if I came off sort of frustrated on Friday. I'm frustrated because this is a more difficult way to run a class, but I miss seeing you all. But I'd really like to see see and hear stuff from y'all. So I have at least one student who has submitted a photograph of their activity, and we'll take a look at that. And I'd love to see also what you have and hear your comments. Again, this is graphing processes with signals. And then finally, we'll give you kind of the staff solution. But please take a second to call up whatever you have for this one, and we'll discuss in one moment. All right, I can't get my screen share to work now, so this is real frustrating. All right, so I'm having trouble with the screen sharing. This is super frustrating. Could one of the TAs call up the, well, we'll look at the solution PDF in just a second. Who in the class can, guys, participate with me in some way. Just tell me like you hate me. I don't care. Say something. We're just like, otherwise it's just me and some computers here.
Does this help any?
There you go. Thanks. There you go. Okay. Now at least I feel a little better because my computer still doesn't do what I needed to do, but at least there's another person on the other end.
Hello. Does my mic work?
Yeah, sounds great. Oh, I know the problem. Okay, so who has a activity to show us? And David, can you make the other MTubes user a co-host? That's why I can't screen share. All right, so I'm going to call up one of these solutions I got from a student. Show me how. Oh, great, that's not working either. Stand by. Infuriating. Okay, well, this is what we'll be able to do. So, so this is one submission we have. It's a photograph of a piece of paper. But what I'm seeing here is the welcome print statement followed by a fork, where we have, in this case, let's see, which one is our child process? Well, we have the case where pit of 0 equals 0. So the thing on the bottom here is going to be the child process. And where pit of 0 is not equal to 0, of course, you all know the result of fork is non-zero for the parent process. Pit of the child goes to the parent. And then the parent process sends the interrupt signal to the child process, which is handled by the SIGINT handler, which actually prints something followed by a call to exit. So the print statement isn't written here, but that's okay. Incidentally, that reminds me, a few people have asked, are you allowed to use a printf statement in a signal handler? And there is a bit in the end of chapter 8 that says some functions are not asynchronous signal safe to be used in signal handlers. And that is a... that's true, and it's a minor detail that we will not be enforcing. So yes, you may use printf in your signal handlers in Shell Lab. Technically, there could be problems with that if one signal handler were to interrupt another signal handler, because like, say, while SIGINT handler is running, another signal comes in, and certain complicated functions get messed up when you interrupt them in the middle. However, that's not going to be an issue for these super short signal handlers, and you can ignore that rule. Anyway, it's occasionally get that question from folks who do a good job of reading chapter 8 really closely. So the SIGINT handler on the back of this page does have a printf in it. Anyway, and then we see the next thing happen. There's two more child processes on the bottom, and they all exit. The other interesting thing, though, is that after the exit, there's this dotted line over to wait PID. And you guys are using the notation that that our TA showed you last week, which is great. So wait PID is, we call that reaping. So, you know, again, the point here isn't really waiting as much as it is checking the status, checking that exit status. So when the child exited with a value of 1, wait PID actually read that and will know how to do something with that. That's relevant to you because when you are doing a SIG child handler in Shell Lab, you need to use this status value that wait PID gets in order to find out, well, why did a child process change? You know, was it SIGINT? Was it SIGTSTOP? Those are our three choices. So, what do y'all want to say about this?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
So, what exactly is printed between the signal handler and the exit? Is that just the printf statement in the third, in the bottom of the activity? Is it one of those statements that's printed out?
Well, what I was referring to is the actually really, you know, would be line 3 if we're looking, you know, the line right before the exit. That would be the child printing that, and then the thing down at the bottom would be printed by the parent. So,
okay.
Yeah, so that's what I'm referring to there. But anyway, I mean, you don't, it's often it's not practical to have every single line in these graphs. In any case, so that's great. I'm going to show you our like official solution, which really is quite similar. It's just sort of laid out a little bit differently. So this is the official solution here, which used to be hand-drawn, and thanks to Caitlin for making it way more legible than my attempt at it. So in this case, we have the parent process staying kind of on the bottom. It's kind of, you know, it's sort of arbitrary, but in the previous example, we had the parent process on top and the children kind of branching off the bottom. So this is our example. We'll post the solution on the schedule page also, so you can refer to it later. But this is each of the child processes being created with fork. And when PID is non-zero, that indicates that that's the case where the parent process. And PID equal to zero is a child process. We've got while loops where they kind of do nothing for a period of time. And then these three sig ints go out and the three exits. So this is pretty similar to what you saw before. So your graphs don't all have to like look exactly the same if they kind of convey this information.
For the while part, for the while part, we don't have to put like a little circle where the while is, like a loop.
Oh, not really. I mean, that's a good question. I mean, this is not really anything happening there. It's not a bad idea though. You know, again, there's not like a hard rule on what this has to look like. The main thing that you want to be able to do is, you know, follow the forks and the signals. You know, again, where this is going to come in handy for you. Well, in one case, there is, you know, breaking out the race condition situation in eval. Being able to graph it really helps you map that out. But also in these cases where we're saying, you know, well, how many times does something happen, or what's the output of a program? You know, those are sort of types of questions that we'll ask you that are easily answered by a process graph. So, I mean, sometimes you can kind of go on like, okay, I'm trying to trace lines of output, so I'm going to look at how many times printf is called, or I'm trying to trace the value of x, so I'll kind of keep track of that along my signal, my process graph, and can kind of exclude things that don't fit that. I don't know. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that's good. Thank you very much.
Cool. And then the next part we kind of want to get to is that we have some questions here. What are the meanings of these things? So what does signal function call do? Well, this is saying registering a signal handler. So this line here, sigint handler is never actually called anywhere in the code, but we do register it here and saying, well, if and when this signal ever arrives, that's the code's going to jump there. It's going to be like a function call to sigint handler. I've had a few questions about like, why is there an argument sig for the signal handler when, of course, sigint is always signal two? Why would we have that as a parameter? Well, the reason is you could have a signal handler that is registered for multiple signals and then like decides what to do based on what's in sig. We don't do it that way in JavaLab, but that's why that's there. But it's a minor thing. Stop me if you got questions. What's going into PID of I here? Well, depends. Depends on, in the case of the parent process, the PID of child goes there. In the case of the child process, zero goes there. And then we use that to determine only the child process goes into the while loop. Finally, this for loop is going through for each of the child processes and reaping with wait PID. So this is calling wait PID for waiting for termination of a specific PID. In shell lab, you're more likely going to use, you're definitely going to use negative one here, which is wait for any child process reap. And then this writes a status into this address of child status. So that's why the address of operator is there. And so this thing child status is going to contain what signal was it? In this case, it's always going to be sigint, but which signal, and this could be different in shell lab. And what was the status of that exit call? So there are these things, w if exited in caps and W exit status in caps that are technically little C preprocessor macros for interpreting this child status thing. There's a page in the text that tells you exactly what these are, and there's a few other ones that you want to use in Shell Lab. So look them up when you need them. Okay, questions?
For the process tree that you made, why do they exit with one instead of zero? Is exit zero reserved for the main function, or does it actually matter?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, so, well, okay, I mean, it's pretty arbitrary, but I mean, we have exit one here just because that's what the child ends up calling when SIGINT happens. So, that one is what gets read by WaitPID, and so the parent process can say, oh, exit with exit status one. And then the parent process calls exit of zero. I mean, in this case, it's basically arbitrary. It's because it's written that way. But is your question, why do we write it that way?
I mean, I just didn't understand why the process tree exited with one, but now that you, I didn't see that SIGINT also exited with one, but that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, in this case, all the children have this exit of one, and then the parent has exit of zero. I mean, you know, traditionally, exit of zero would indicate zero errors, everything is normal, which is true, main ended normally. In this case, the child process exited with the SIGINT handler as if that was some sort of different type of exit. So that's why they have a different value there.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question. All right. Thanks for talking to me, folks. I feel better already. So we'll post these solutions. Hopefully this is, you know, again, helpful to you in as you're working on Shell Lab and as you are answering other questions about signals and forks and all that.
Excuse me?
Yes.
I want to add, so in Shell Lab, I put for like signal, for the signal handlers, for example, for SIGINT, whenever we're sending the signals, I didn't put in like the, for what was inside the parameters. I put in the actual SIGINT. Is it better for me to put the signal that was passed into the function?
Okay. Yeah. You know, it really doesn't matter in this case. I mean, for SIGINT, this thing SIG is always going to be two. So like, you know, we could have hard coded two in here and it wouldn't be wrong. So this is really only necessary for a signal handler that deals with multiple signals. So I'm going to say no big deal. I mean, if you're passing the test and it's doing the right thing, then don't worry too much.
All right. Sounds good.
Yes. Good question. All right. So I have a few other Shell Lab notes for y'all. Let's see if I can get to that now. Let's see. Okay. So I think I've mentioned some of these before. So many people have in their eval, I called a WaitPID, did that in your demo. Great. That's not going to work for background jobs. I think I mentioned a few times. The example in the book is that's sort of a flawed eval that you can start with. So you'll need to be using WaitFG is the thing that that just does the waiting, and then WaitPID will be called in the SIG child handler to do the reaping. So WaitFG, all it does is wait. WaitPID does the reaping. And this WaitFG thing can really just be a repeated check to the list. You have these useful helper functions, fgpid and getjobpid. And you can put a sleep one in there to sort of slow it down a little bit. Incidentally, just thought I'd mention, you know that Shell Lab due date's coming up. If your schedule has been turned upside down in the last week or two, we understand, because I think it's true of almost everyone. So we may be willing to be extra lenient on the Shell Lab due date. Please stay in touch with us if you've had any unexpected things come up. Well, okay, so that's everyone. So keep working towards Shell Lab. We may give you a little bit of reprieve. So don't stress out too much, but also keep making small progress. I'll give you specifics on that soon. We'll meet with the SCORE staff and figure out what to do. Okay, there's some stuff about the jobs list. I think I showed a little bit about this before. There is an array that's already defined in the program called jobs. It's an array of things called structs of type job type. A single job would be jobs of zero. Jobs with no index is a pointer at the beginning of it. We'll be dealing with more pointer stuff. Don't worry. But we have add job and clear job available to you. Well, so add job is what you're going to use to add to the jobs list. It will deal with all the pointer stuff. You just have to call it properly. This just has some examples of using this is already written what add job looks like. I think in some other cases I've gone through in more details. But just some things about what's happening here. There is this this thing here, this operator here, the pointer dereference struct pointer access. Ugh, sorry, I'm having a little problem with this. This is a way of dereferencing a pointer and accessing a member of the struct. We'll deal with this more when we deal with pointers, but I just wanted to kind of give you reference to where you can look up what this means. There are a couple of cases where you might actually use this in Shell Lab. So before we go into our next little section about memory and caching, I just wanted to come back to one other thing with the proc file system. And that is a little activity which should be on the course site. Let's try to call that up. So if you go to here, let's see. So if we go to the schedule page, this should be here, proc activity. So check this out. This is actually kind of interesting and it's usually kind of fun thing to do in the classroom, but we're not in the classroom. So let's take a look at this. So if you're able to go to Systems Lab web, you can log in and do this. I'll kind of show you what it looks like. And later on, we have some blanks to fill in. So when you are doing this activity, you can answer a few questions to kind of show us that you got into this. But this would involve logging in. So let me attempt to show you. So you've all used this Systems Lab web thing to log in. So this is sort of our version of being in the classroom. So if I look at our activity, dealing with files and file descriptors, so which of course is related to the input, output, redirect stuff that you're dealing with in Shell Lab and that we've kind of done all semester. So again, just to remind, I want you to be able to do something like, let's see here. So tshref is able to do then ls. Okay, sure, you know that. But can we take then ls and write it to some file? LS was still, there's still a fork in exec. LS is run and written to some file. And in fact, we can read it from that file. So that's what an output redirect looks like. This is done with the do redirect function, which is started for you but not finished. You need to finish the function. You also need to call it in eval or it won't do anything. So let's do a little more file descriptors. So what this activity says is log in and open a terminal. And I'm just going to go back to this go back to this directory here. So we can fetch a PDF. We're going to deal with a PDF as an example here. So I can, and fortunately I know the URLs for this website, but it's written on the activity. So we can actually grab the PDF of the slides from Friday like this. So this program wget just downloads it for us into a file. So here's this file of some 11 million bytes, a lot of bytes there. And we have a PDF viewing program called events. So this is item number 3 on this activity. So this actually is a program that views PDF files, and you've maybe even used something like this when we had it in the classroom. You know, I can scroll around, I can, you know, page up and page down, I can even click over here. Anyway, the point of this activity is to look at the proc file system. So I'm actually going to make another terminal window and take a look around here and see what we can see. Because I have this thing here. This PDF program is itself a process. So I'm going to look up what this process is. So we can use the ps command. Actually, we can say I want all processes by user matoops to, 1, which is who's running all this. So that gave me more than I wanted, but what we care about is in the bottom. This is my PDF viewer program, and this is my, you know, I see my shell, I see my PS program. Interestingly, so, you know, we talked about, okay, so files are, you know, represented by, we access with open and close and read and write, just regular bits of data on the disk, but also devices such as the terminal. So my other window where I was running bash has terminal PTS6. That's what the TTY is what that is up here. So so actually this is a device on the file system. So dev PTS6 is, well, it's owned by me. It's my terminal. And actually, if I just look at dev PTS, I mean, I can see everyone who's logged in with a shell on Systems Lab has a terminal. There's some of you in the class. You might see your name or your friend's name in there. So two of them are mine. I have two windows open. But this is something we can read, you know, we can write to these things, even though it's not a file on the disk. I can actually say, hello, terminal device. And I can actually write that to dev PTS6. And in fact, where is it? Is it? Ah, there it is. Hello, terminal device. So my shell just wrote to this thing dev PTS6. Now, if I say dev PTS8, that's the other one I opened. And in fact, there it is. So we can write to these things. Now you might say, oh, can I write to dev PTS4? I write to Israel screen? Well, that's not. I'm not allowed to do that. Only Israel is allowed to do that. So that's how we can stop from annoying each other. If you're the system administrator, you can override that, but we won't go there. So that's just an interesting example of a file that is not stored on disk, but it's actually the screen. The terminal is itself a file. Another interesting bunch of files we have is this thing called proc, which is what this activity is about. So I'm going to focus on this process ID right here, 19333. So we have this whole file system on Linux systems called proc. And in case I've forgotten that number already, I'll put it here. And by the way, we have a blank on here so that you're not forgetful like me and forgetting the PID. But this is the PID we're concerned with, 19333. So we have this whole directory, proc19333. It's not actually on the disk. It is kind of dealing with this PID 19333. When this process goes away, all this directory goes away also. So there's all these things that are properties of a process. We're going to look at this whole directory called FD. These are file descriptors. And my PDF program, well, it has standard input and standard output, which are always file descriptors 0 and 1, devpts6. Well, that was this thing over here. Devpts6 represents that terminal window. There's a whole bunch of sockets and event stuff that has to do with the graphic interface. But eventually, there is file descriptor 15 is the PDF file itself. And, you know, again, this makes sense. We know that our PDF viewer has to read the PDF file that it's putting up on the screen over here that it's displaying to me. So it has to get that data from somewhere. It's doing reads on file descriptor 15 for that particular process. Every process you could look up as file descriptors in here. So the idea is that you can go through this activity and also kind of poke around and learn about your own PDF viewer. You could do this for a web browser or a more complicated program also and get a lot more involved. The other interesting thing to do here is that we can take this, you know, again, this is my PDF viewer. I can hit Control Z here. So this is the SIG T-stop. Again, this is Bash handling SIG T-stop the way that, very similar to what your shell will do. I typed Control Z, Bash printed stopped. Of course, Tiny Shell has like a slightly different format, but now this thing events is stopped. So what does this mean? Well, like, wait a second. Now I'm trying to scroll. Can I click on it? Like, what is going on? I can't click on files, Unix.io. Nothing's happening. That's because it stopped. This process will not get scheduled. It won't do anything until it's resumed. So, but we can actually, there's this whole, let me go back to this window in proc. There's a whole thing called status, which is all this stuff about the process, not all of which we're going to go into, of course, but this is in state T for stopped. Of course, PS can display this also. Of course, I have a PID. I have a parent PID, which is the shell that started it. All kinds of other stuff. What I think is interesting here, okay, so there's signals pending, signals blocked, all these signal masks are in here. And then there's context switches, voluntary and non-voluntary context switches. And right now, this is not changing because it's not ever getting scheduled. But if I say, well, let's see, I can put this in the background. So now, wrong terminal. So now, all my clicks and stuff started doing stuff again. And in fact, I will see context switches, 2504 and 280. So now that this program's actually doing stuff, there's all these context switches happening. Remember, this is the switching back and forth that the operating system does between all these processes. You go, now you go, now you go. So there are thousands of these. Now when the program isn't actually doing anything, that number doesn't go up. If the program is doing like a lot of stuff, for a long period of time, you know, my systems lab kernel is still switching between like all of your processes too. So like there, thousands more context switches happen. So that's just kind of a summary of the fun stuff you can do in this activity here. It's on the schedule. Please check it out. You got questions and thoughts on that, y'all?
Nope.
Wait, I had like a quick question. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, go for it.
So when you stopped the PDF viewing program and then you moved it to the background, it automatically switches to like not stopped?
No, I resumed it by typing BG here. So now Now this is running in the background. Again, this is Bash's jobs command, looks a little different than TSH's jobs command. I could also put this in the foreground and then stop it again. So now it's in state stopped, and now like it won't move or do anything when I click on it. I can start it up again, you know, and this is, you know, this is relevant to Shell Lab, right? Because when I type FG or BG, I'm sending sig const, the continue signal. And in fact, all those clicks I did before suddenly do stuff.
Okay, I understand. But
yeah, thanks for pointing that out. I did that a little quickly. So that is the proc file system, and we see some stuff with file descriptors. We see some stuff with signals and process states that really like a whole bunch of the stuff we did with processes and context switches and all the stuff we've done the last few weeks is all kind of summed up in this little activity. So that's why we wrote this up and want you to check it out, because it's like real stuff that happens on real systems all the time. All right. So, and if you take it further, there's some stuff dealing with output redirect and stuff, and you'll see exactly what happens when dupe2 is called. So, that means we've pretty much done everything in class, discussed everything in class that we'll get to and have you doing in Shell Lab. So, what I want to do now is move us to our next little section talking about computer memory. And this is going to tell us a lot about how systems perform, how programs perform, and in terms of how fast they are, and also like why computers are designed the way they do, why some programs are fast and slow, some are slow. Of course, you may remember this from the beginning of the semester when we had you do the intro lab and talked a little tiny bit about caching and why two programs that do the same thing might not take the same amount of time. So I'm just gonna get us started on this, and this is gonna take us into chapter 6 in the book that we'll spend a little bit of time on and teach you a little bit about and have a little bit in our next exam about, but hopefully give you good insight and also get you ready for your operating systems class. So we'll kind of start out by just going over what computer memory is briefly. This is, you know, just from the systems point of view, not going to go too far into like what the hardware electrical engineers do, but it's something that our computers depend on. So let's learn a bit about it. That is not where we're supposed to start. Sorry. Computer memory, section one. So what is it? These are pictures of computer memory. If you've ever worked on the inside of a computer or upgraded a computer, whether a desktop or laptop or server, you may have come across these things. These are the chips that make up computer memory. Your computer has one or more of these things called a DIMM. So these are big groups of little chips, and they eventually contain a whole bunch of things called cells, and a cell stores exactly one bit of data, a zero or a one, that it does electrically, and we don't need to know much more about how it does that electrically, there are two important things we care about, there are two big categories, static RAM and dynamic RAM. We'll talk quickly about what those mean. But static RAM is much faster and more expensive, and it does not need to be refreshed constantly, whereas dynamic RAM is something that the data in there only stays in there for fractions of a second, and so many times per second it's constantly being updated, kept fresh. So your main memory is the thing that, you know, when you say your laptop has 16 gigabytes of RAM or main memory, you're talking about dynamic RAM, and then our caches are made out of static RAM. So our system has both of these. This is engineers often look at how many transistors it takes to build one of these or to store a single bit. So static RAM is more complicated and more expensive. And so our system uses both, and we'll kind of talk about why. So so we say these are volatile memories and that when the computer is powered off, everything goes away. So that's why we have a disk for actually storing your files, your long-term data, and your memory. This RAM stuff is just for what you're using, you know, at a given point in time when your computer is on and running. So there's types of non-volatile memory, ROM, and these various versions of read-only memory. These start out as something that, you know, really just get written once only to those that you can read and write. And then eventually the things that we call flash memory that you may use as a portable device or, in your phone, these are just the fanciest version of these non-volatile memories. Non-volatile memories end up getting used all over the place inside our hardware and also your portable devices. We're gonna talk more about the volatile memory, which is something that our operating systems use a lot. So this is a diagram, and those of you who are in a computer org class, if you're not in there now, you will be, but you probably look at similar diagrams, am I right? So I keep accidentally moving the slide up. So we've been talking a bunch in this class about registers and move operations, moving data into registers to operate on them. So that move instruction grabs something from the main memory and pulls it into registers where it can get operated on. This thing bus is really the wires that actually move all of that. So we've been looking a lot at, you know, processor instructions and registers and just talking about, oh, this stuff's coming from memory or it's getting stored in memory. Let's talk a little bit more about what this memory is. The reason why we're going to talk about this is we want to look at the amount of time it takes to read and write from this stuff. So, and how this has changed over time. And this is a really interesting graph that I think has huge implications for us. So let's take a look. On the left is our x-axis. This is a logarithmic scale, log base 10. So, you know, it's 10, you know, 10 is 10 times bigger than 1, and 100 is 10 times bigger than 10. Each of these steps is a factor of 10 larger than the previous. And this is access time in nanoseconds. Nanoseconds are 1 billionth of a second. So when we talk about something that takes 100 nanoseconds, well, 100 billionths of a second, so we can flip that over, you know, hertz is one thing per second, and megahertz would be 10, or would be 1 million things per second, 1 million accesses per second. So this would be about, well, this line here, 1,000 nanoseconds would be about 1 megahertz, and this would be 10 megahertz, right? And this would be 100, and then this would be 1 gigahertz if we're talking about number of accesses per second. And you're probably familiar with these hertz terms from your processor, which if you've looked at, you know, processors today are usually in the 2 to 3 gigahertz range, 2 to 3 billion accesses per second, which is going to be down here, less than 1 nanosecond per access. So, but this is going back to 1985 or so, as you've heard us mention, you know, the Intel-based processors that we use are not dramatically different from the way they were then, but just faster. And so they've gotten a lot faster since the 1980s. You know, this is basically, you know, almost 10 times faster. This is, you know, from 1985 to 1995, that's like, you know, more than a factor of 10 faster. So these processors are getting faster and faster. But the memory, the DRAM is getting, it's getting a bit faster, but not nearly as dramatically as the CPUs, as the processors. And then disk, the thing that like permanently stores data, is way up here. I mean, we're talking many, many, many orders of magnitude slower than everything else. So it takes a long time to read data off a disk. That's part of why we, you know, do that once in the beginning and then hold it in memory while it's being used. This used to be very evident when computers had loud spinning hard drives, that you would hear a bunch of noise when your computer was reading a bunch of data from there. And a lot of times when someone's computer got slow, they would like hear lots of like clicking sounds and stuff. And they would know that was poor speed of their computer was related to doing a lot of reads from the disk. Anyway, so there's a lot of stuff in this graph about trends in computer hardware, and it really explains a lot about why systems work the way they do now. So if the processor can execute billions of instructions per second, that's, you know, gigahertz, okay, that's amazing. But where does it get those instructions from? Well, those instructions come from main memory, which is DRAM, and DRAM can maybe do tens or hundreds of millions of accesses per second, much less than billions per second. Again, let's just kind of back up to here. You know, we're talking about, you know, even if we're looking at year 2000, there's like more than a factor of 10 difference between the CPU and DRAM, and it's gotten even wider since then. So we have this processor that can do billions of things per second, but the thing that gives it those things to do is slower than that. So we call this a bottleneck. So what is the point of this processor that is super fast and can do billions of things per second if the thing it gets those instructions from isn't fast enough to feed it instructions, billions of instructions per second? That is the fundamental challenge here. Our processors are so fast that nothing else can keep up. And so are they pointless? Is all that speed just going to waste? That's the big dilemma here. So that is going to lead us to talking about locality and caching. So please do read about these terms in chapter 6. And it all kind of comes back to this graph here. I know at least some of you are interested in computer hardware and interested in why a computer is slow or fast, and why do we have all these crazy things called caches and stuff like that. So please read up on it, and please check out the activities we've mentioned today. And I don't know, do you guys have any questions or thoughts on this yet?
Well,
no, not on the question yet.
Oh, you go ahead.
No, I was just saying I didn't have a question, but you can go.
I was saying, is there like an updated graph since this thing is 2015 of like the next step?
Good question. I'm sure there is. I don't have it. You want to help me research that? Part of why you're seeing 2015 is that, you know, the textbook we're using was published in 2016 and they're doing 5-year increments. So, you know, it hasn't been 2020 very long yet. But yeah, that's a good question. One thing you may notice though is that on the CPU stuff, like, you know, and you may have noticed this too if you've gone like shopping for a processor, that like they haven't, you know, changed the gigahertz speeds in many years. And that's actually what the meaning of this like separated line is here, is that while the individual processors haven't actually got faster in cycle time, we say effective CPU cycle time, because this is basically saying, well, okay, now we have two processors or four cores that are all 2 billion instructions per second. So they're kind of considered more effective instructions per second. But in any case, what's really changed in the last 5 years has probably been mostly number of cores on a processor rather than just the raw speed itself. I can tell you that processor and DRAM are still, somewhere close to a factor of 100 apart in speed. You know, even if, you know, I mean, how much different can this graph really be 5 years later, right? I mean, in each of these 5-year blocks, like we don't see huge changes happening. Like the DRAM is still way behind the processor and the processor is still way ahead of everyone else. Now the solid state disk, much better than the old hard drive, but still huge difference there.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the SSD because like a lot of these like first jumps is like almost half an order of magnitude. So I'm wondering if the SSD also has like a similar like jump.
Like our SSDs getting faster?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, great. I'd like some more data on that too. I mean, yes, they are getting faster, but at what rate? But even if they're getting way faster, when you're starting out, like, you know, this is like thousands of times slower than DRAM. So, how much of a slope does it really make? It's definitely not getting like that much better. And that would still put it way behind. So like, the trends are kind of interesting here, but like the, you know, ordering of these things is definitely not changing. They're very, very far apart. And then of course, we're noticing here, the round thing here is your SRAM, which we make caches out of, and the square thing is your DRAM, which our main memory is made out of. So, the SRAM is way, way faster than DRAM, kind of regardless of what the next like slope is in these lines. And that's still quite a bit slower than CPU speed.
Yeah. I think SSDs have just been getting cheaper and cheaper, not necessarily faster. They have been getting a lot cheaper.
Like per megabyte or per gigabyte,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And people are usually like kind of concerned with how much stuff they can store there rather than how fast it is. And the part of that is that we've designed our systems to like not suck, right? So, when our hard drives are so much slower than everything else in the system, our computers still worked okay with regular hard drives. Because we have extensive systems to cache as much as possible using DRAM and using SRAM. So even when the storage medium is much slower, we can still get decent performance, and we'll talk about caching and how that works coming up. But yeah, I mean, you really care about how much stuff your SSD can store, not exactly how fast it is. I mean, you like that it's faster than the disk, but really when you're using things and when things are working properly, everything you need should be held in your DRAM anyway. So, hopefully you're not waiting on the disk or waiting on the SSD all the time when you're trying to get stuff done. And if you are, then that's when things start to be bad. And so when you are, if you're making software and you want to make it so that, things are waiting on things like DRAM and SRAM and not waiting on disk or solid state drive to provide data. Anyway, appreciate your thoughts there. And like I said, please do check out the proc file system activity, as I think it's pretty cool to put all of this stuff into look at it in a real system that you use. All the stuff about signals and file descriptors and all that, we didn't just make it up. You can see it on all your real programs. Of course, we have help hours tomorrow afternoon, and so we would love to see you. Just please stop by and say hi. And hope you're all doing well. Hope you're all in good health. And thanks for participating today, folks. I appreciate it.
What time's help hours again?
Well, 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And I see Mark has put a link in the chat to some speeds of solid state drives. I will check that out, and we can discuss.
Matthew, if it's okay, I have a question about one of my my do redirect. My
sure, shell. Go for it.
So for some reason, whenever I tested it, test 19 and 20 passed, but test 18 is saying it has permission denied whenever it wants to
concatenate. So this is, this is probably when, we had you create a file, like ls got written out to a file, yeah. And let me see if I can call up an example of that. But ls got written to a file. Ben went and Ben Cat to read back that file. It got a permission denied error. I think that's probably what that is. So here, let me demonstrate for folks if I can call this back up again. So I'm going to send SIGINT because I'm done with these. I'm done with these slides on the right. Controls work so well. Okay, so your shell, I guess I should do this in tshref. So ran this and wrote it to some file, but then this resulted in permission denied instead of what we just saw, right?
Right.
So,
right.
Why would we get a permission denied here? Well, so this thing test file has certain permissions here. I mean, in this case, it's read write for the owner and nothing for everyone else. What those permissions are is actually set by your shell in your do redirect function. So wherever you call open, where you're calling open, there's a thing in here with permissions. And so if your permissions were, too restrictive and then cat couldn't read the file, then that's what resulted in the permission denied. So this is the manual page. So there's a way to call open with two arguments and a way with three arguments. So I think what you want to do is set this thing mode, and you can look up, there's some stuff in chapter 10 about this, or you can read the manual page, but you'll need to change this third thing to open to be more permissive. That'll tell you where to look to fix that. Okay. That should be a minor fix.
Right, but because I thought it was gonna something to do with the flags, where right now I have them as like create, write only, and truncate. But should I have one of those be read as well?
No, the open flags are fine because you're actually not, when LS is writing out that file, it's actually not reading from it. It's just it's only writing. But so the flags are just for like what actions that process is gonna take. But the mode thing is actually permissions for like later things that access it. So I think your flags are okay. It's the mode thing that needs to change.
All right. Right. Thank you very much.
Anyway, good. That's good. That's a good specific question. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. I don't know if y'all got an email about this. This may have just gone to grad students, but there is a seminar today that the CS department is hosting that, normally would be in person, but is, going to be held on Zoom. I think they really invited all the grad students, but I think undergrads are welcome also. I guess you need the link then. I'll put the link in the chat if y'all want to come hear a talk about, let's see, what is it about? Well, I'll let y'all know in the chat. And like I said, hope to see y'all tomorrow. Hope you're doing well. The talk is about data quality and security evaluation on mobile devices. Well, we're all interested in mobile devices, I think. So I'll give you that link shortly.